got a sprain or an itch.
Welcome to another edition of the Hey Doc Show. Dr. Harold Lasky is both the medical director and physician at Southside Medical Center, right here in Jacksonville, Florida. Dr. Lasky will be your host for the next half hour. With him today is his co-host and lovely wife Carmen Lasky, a certified EMT. Together they hope that you will find the show informative, educational, as well as entertaining.
Welcome to this Saturday's edition of the Hey Doc Show. I'm Dr. Harold Lasky, and I have a special guest here that would like to say something to you. Alessandro, what would you like to tell our audience?
Cogito ergo sum.
Alessandro, most of us, including our audience here, probably do not understand Latin. Can you translate that for us?
Sorry, I will translate it for you. Cogito ergo sum means, I think, therefore I am.
And Alessandro, who actually uttered this famous line?
A Frenchman, Antoine Lavoisier, who was a nobleman and a famous chemist during the French Revolution.
Thank you very much, Alessandro, for visiting us here on the Hey Doc Show.
It was a pleasure being here with you and your beautiful wife, Carmen.
In philosophy, there's a fairly well-known proposal called the Brain in Vat Theory, or BIV. It depicts a thought experiment where certain features of the human conceptions of knowledge, reality, truth, mind, consciousness, and meaning are discussed. In this experiment, it is assumed that the brain of some imagined person has been carefully removed from the unsuspecting volunteer and placed in a nutrient vat that keeps the brain alive and well. Part of the experiment is a simulation, such that the thoughts can be read by an outsider, but the volunteer whose brain has been removed only exists in unreality, as the brain has no knowledge that it is anything but a real person, with all actions and reactions being simulated by what you may call a neuroscientist, the owner of the brain in a vat.
In this experiment, a computer would be simulating reality, including appropriate responses to the brain's own output. The disembodied brain would continue to have perfectly normal conscious experiences, such as those of a person with a normal brain, without this being related to objects or events in the real world.
Since the brain in a vat gives and receives exactly the same impulses as it would if it were in a skull, and since these are its only way of interacting with the environment, then it is not possible to tell from the perspective of that brain whether it is in a skull or in a vat. So as the theory goes, how do you and I know, and I am using the term know in a strict sense, how do you and I know that we are not just a brain in a vat being programmed to believe that we're doing and feeling everything, when in reality, a computer is simulating all information going into that brain?
Perhaps the information is that the volunteer is eating a delicious ice cream. He or she can taste it, feel the cold, see the cone and the color of the ice cream, and yet not understand that these beliefs are false.
After all, in our imaginary experiment, we're just a brain in a vat. So the argument of this theory is that one cannot know whether one is a brain in a vat, and therefore one cannot know whether most of one's beliefs might be completely false. Recently, many contemporary philosophers believe that virtual reality will seriously affect human autonomy as a form of brain in a vat. But others, of course, dispute this and have another view, in that virtual reality will not destroy our cognitive structures or take away our connection with reality.
On the contrary, they believe that virtual reality will allow us to have more new propositions, new insights, and new perspectives to see the world.
Think back to the movie Total Recall. During the time that the hero is hooked up to the machine, he is living in what he believes is total reality. We could call this brain in a vat a disembodied brain.
Remember that Lavoisier's answer to this age-old question was, I think, therefore I am.
But What is the brain exactly? Can a brain exist at all without a body, without input or output?
Let's suppose we were futuristic and could input everything such as touch, smell, hearing, and sight into a brain. Would the brain know that the inputs are artificial?
What if we then created entire new bodies that could connect to the brain, bodies that were virtually indistinguishable from the real parts? Would our brains somehow know it? So, Carmen, if we talk about the brain in its simplest of terms, what can we say about it?
First of all, we could say that it is made up of just fats and proteins. We could also say that it consists of four parts. These are the cerebrum, cerebellum, the brainstem, and the diencephalon.
These are terms that you may only be partly familiar with, especially that last term, diencephalon.
The biggest portion is called the cerebrum, and it is the one that we are most familiar with visually. It makes up 3/4 of the total brain.
It's mainly made up of neurons and nerve fibers that transmit information from the neurons within the body and the brain. We will get to more about that particular part of the brain once we define the other regions.
The cerebrum controls higher functions. By that we mean things like learning, speech, and thinking, as well as the senses such as sight and hearing.
The cerebellum is the second largest part of the brain. It also has nerve cells and nerve fibers, just like the cerebellum.
It carries signals to other parts of the brain and the spinal cord, and is responsible for coordinating muscle movements such as giving us the ability to stand without falling over, walk and run.
It's especially useful in maintaining balance and equilibrium. Otherwise, we simply couldn't ride a bicycle or even dance. Have you ever watched a horse move through various gaits, such as the walk, the gallop, pace, canter, which together make up the classification of what are called natural gaits, as well as those that are called ambling gaits, which include, among others, the foxtrot, the rack, reval, and the tolt? By the way, the tolt is a pretty unique gait to the Icelandic horse. Now, this would be the horse that I'd love to own were I to purchase one. Just my own personal preference.
But if you watch a horse that is demonstrating the various gaits, one after the other, you can almost see how the horse's brain is working as the feet move differently as the horse changes gait.
It's not just the speed of the horse, but which feet move in unison and which don't during each of the gaits. You don't even need to have a horse. I can see this in a dog's change of gait as it walks, then breaks into a different gait where the front feet move together and the back ones do as well. Now, this dog does not have to think about doing it. The brain does this subconsciously.
Now, we come to the inner part of the brain called the brainstem. It anchors the rest of the brain to the spinal cord. The spinal cord is made up of various parts, including the pons, which is made up of nerve fibers that carry sensory information, and the midbrain, which is involved in bodily movement along with visual and auditory processing.
There's also the medulla oblongata, the final part of the brainstem, which creates motor and sensory pathways between the other parts of the midbrain and an area called the pons and the spinal cord. So what are the functions of this midbrain? First of all, it controls the heart's activities, breathing, digestion, as well as sleep.
And finally, we get to talk about the core of the brain called the diencephalon. It is made up of the thalamus, which processes and transmits information from all senses other than smell, and the hypothalamus, as well as pituitary gland, which work together to produce and regulate neurochemicals.
These structures help govern sensations, weight regulation, energy, and instinctual behavior, such as eating, drinking, and having sex. Interestingly, as the brain works both independently and as a group to maintain all body functions, it is also into self-preservation. In other words, the brain protects itself. You've probably heard of the blood-brain barrier. This basically is a cellular protective wall that only allows specific chemicals to pass from one to the other.
Babies are born pretty much helpless. Sure, they can cry, eat, burp, and hiccup. but they cannot walk, talk, or understand language. These skills need to be learned, and that takes time.
Other animals don't need this, and right from the birth, they can literally fend for themselves. But we are not going to talk about that today. A baby is born with all of its neurons and connections that it will need through life. No more, no less. But it is what we do with them that changes over time.
As a matter of fact, there are so many interconnections just within the brain that a signal can go from any one place in the brain to any other in milliseconds.
Different skills and skill sets have a time period where they are best learned.
So, there are certain periods in our lives where there is increased plasticity for shaping neural circuitry. These are called critical periods.
You know, we all use terms like plasticity. You hear them all the time in science and philosophy. But I looked it up in the dictionary to make it much clearer so that we understand fully what we are talking about. According to the Merriam-Webster's Dictionary, among other non-biologic definitions, the one that best defines our use of the term plasticity is the capacity for continuous alteration of the neural pathways and synapses of the living brain and nervous system in response to experience or injury.
So, for every skill that we master, there is a golden period when learning is easier. It is during this period of time that our neural circuitry becomes, as they say, fine-tuned. Our brain learns about which connections are important and which ones are not.
I remember when computers were in their infancy, that anything similar to a GP map system was far slower than a person's thinking. For example, let's say that you decide to go from Jacksonville to Salem, Oregon, and you're trying to map out the fastest route. You might take out a map and look at it. Immediately, you could, even without apparently thinking, discard all routes that went through, let's say, Bangor, Maine, or cities in Lower California.
You would then look for the thickest lines on the map that are closest to a route that may be, as the crow flies, straight to Oregon.
On the other hand, although computers were fast and even faster today, the computer would have to try every route, including those going through Maine and Lower California, rejecting all those with longer-lasting trips to finally get you to the fastest route. Nowadays, we do have fuzzy logic and other algorithms created by humans that probably can better simulate the way that human thought creates an answer to a problem, such as finding the best route to Salem, Oregon.
This is a great time to tell you about Southside Medical Center. Dr. Lasky has been the medical director and physician at Southside Medical Center for the past 34 years. They are located at 3604 Southside Boulevard, just two blocks south of the Beach Boulevard intersection, between the Tulsa Welding School and the old Pottsburg Post Office. They will treat your pains, sprains, and strains. Dr. Lasky and Carmen are proud to welcome Dr. Susan Pollan, MD, a board-certified pain specialist to the practice. The office emphasizes the treatment of chronic pain. They also have an office-based substance treatment program for those who need it. Southside Medical Center is open 10 a.m. to 5 p.m., Monday through Friday. If you would like to make an appointment or ask any questions about Southside Medical Center, please call their office at 641-4411. That's 641-4411, Southside Medical Center, where your health is their primary care.
Welcome back to the Hey Doc Show.
In our brain, certain connections become reinforced and others discarded. Some connections are not activated and become lost as they are not learned to be necessary, especially through repeated use.
These connections can actually be thought to die off and then they're lost. When I was a young adult, I met a physician whose mother was a native Spanish speaker, while his father spoke English. And he also had a nanny who spoke almost no Spanish or English, as she was born and raised in France. By the time that he was a teenager, he already spoke all three languages without any accent.
Could he have done this if he began learning the languages later in life? Probably not.
Wouldn't it be great if we could, no matter what age we were? So you are 40 and decide to take up the guitar. Your hope is to one day, well, be as good as, let's say, the likes of Jimi Hendrix, Jimmy Page, or Eddie Van Halen.
Or maybe you want to be able to sing opera like Enrico Caruso, Maria Callas, or even John Sutherland.
What if we found a way to do it, virtually no matter how old you started to learn? Remember that most of Einstein's theories were published before the age of 40. In fact, he was 26 when he published his first four Annus Mirabilis, or Miraculous Year papers, including special relativity, and 36 when he published his completed version of general relativity.
What if we could change something so that we could learn as easily as we did when we were children? This concept is called the Holy Grail of neuroscience.
At this period in history, we are at a time that we can reopen some critical periods so that we can learn like we did in that golden period of learning. We defined plasticity previously, but what is neuroplasticity specifically? Well, it's the ability of the brain to adapt to changing circumstances. In other words, to change the brain to be able to learn.
During this learning time, we also have to balance the brain's power with something referred to as brain stability. Remember that the neurons communicate with each other through electricity. To be more specific, chemical electrical signaling.
These connections between individual nerves are not direct connections like you may see at, for example, a light switch, where all you need to do to make the light work is to close the physical connection of one wire to the next. Again, here we are generally talking about a physical, real-time connection.
It is different in the human body, and especially the brain, where the connections only have the nerve endings near each other at an area called the synapse.
This is where one nerve ending communicates by stimulating the next nerve ending through chemicals, and a chemical reaction within the synapse that causes the next nerve to fire and thus sends the electrical impulse down that nerve to another synapse or an end organ, such as a muscle, in order to make the muscle contract. The brain is not unwired initially, but rather follows a regulated path of wiring. But there's also learning that creates and prunes those connections between different parts of the brain.
It is often difficult to realize that although the brain only takes up 2% of the body's weight, it uses 20% of blood flow and 25% of the glucose.
So it appears that as the brain develops in its early stages, it seems to be overproducing neurons and synapses. But then, through a learning process, those synapses that get activated remain, and those that don't, well, they may fade away. Now, this may seem inefficient, but think about it for a moment. Humans live in very varied environments with different needs, different ways to gain nutrition, and varying capabilities.
Where some of the lower animals, for example, can only subsist in one single environment and live on a very limited diet.
We need this pruning process to be included in our brain growth to be able to specifically learn those things that we as individuals need. He who lives on the equator lives a different life from one who exists, for example, near Juneau, Alaska. For example, certain whale species literally use an entirely different sound language than other species, depending on where they grew up. And even when they come together in the ocean, still maintain their own language and can only communicate with those that learn the same sounds as young whales.
In other words, humans appear to be particularly good at adaptation, and that is the crux of plasticity and its success in molding the thinking process of humans.
So, can an old dog learn new tricks? Well, yes, and so can old humans. But the brain does not have a single best period of learning. It seems, at least from the scientific evidence, that the brain learns in what they refer to as a backward C-slope curve, where regions that are low and in the back of the brain tend to develop earlier, while those in the front mature later.
So our sensory system developed earlier, then the motor and communicative system develop, and then finally the more connective systems such as emotion, connection, and academic performance.
It really seems to be intuitive as to what develops first. You need to be able to sense your surroundings initially so as to hide from danger. Then you need the motor skills to protect yourself from the danger. And finally, the other skills to make use of your environment to your best advantage.
It takes a lot of energy over time to raise a human from infancy to maturity. That is why we as humans tend to stay teaching and protecting our children for a good part of their first 18 years.
Imagine the cost in calories, that is energy, over those 18 years. What we need now is a different approach to what we have had in the past. The old adage is that we start out as babies, go through adolescence and maturity, and then just as before, we digress, sometimes to an almost infant age.
What we would all like is to be able to continually learn and progress throughout our entire lifespan.
Some systems, of course, need stability and not constant progression. This is, in fact, what happens in the visual system. We want some plasticity early in life, but stability of vision throughout the rest of our lives. Think about vision by thinking of each eye as a camera connected somehow within the brain so that the brain really contemplates only one image.
This does not come naturally at first. The brain actually has to learn how to put the two images together as one during infancy. The first binocular cells are built into the back of the brain in the occipital region, which we call the primary visual cortex.
It's interesting to note that initially, these pathways, one from each eye, are not appropriately connected in the visual region. And as time goes by, they intertwine in a, let's call it, binocular path with right eye, left eye stripes. A very interesting experiment was done demonstrating the use it or lose it function.
When an older person, say in his 50s, who has had maybe 10 years with the growing cataract, has successful surgery, he may be blessed with great vision after the surgery.
However, if a young child with congenital cataracts has surgery that removes the cataract, he may still be blind in that eye, since the pathways never developed as they had in the older person. This is the use it or lose it concept.
So the question for researchers and scientists is whether we can open up these paths later in life so that we can get new pathways to develop.
In other words, we want, and not just in the visual pathways, to be able to recreate those things similar to a baby with congenital cataracts, to be able to later have the body produce the pathways so he too can have perfect vision.
Remember again, we are not talking only about vision. Other learned pathways may be like learning to play the guitar at age 90.
To do this, we have to learn what the molecular mechanisms in the body that control the development, both in creation and pruning of the neurons and synapses in the brain are.
How does the brain know, for lack of a better term, which synapses should be pruned and which ones should be created?
Studies have already been done that show certain molecules that when they are not available, permit the persistence of the critical period in the visual systems and do not allow pruning to be done. They are just now in the early stages, and maybe someday they'll be able to create a pill that allows us to, for example, as I said, learn to sing opera at any age, or learn a foreign language without any accent way into our older years.
But like with everything else, increasing plasticity may come at a price. It is thought that autism may actually be a developmental process where the brain has too much plasticity and too little pruning, and that is what causes the abnormality of thinking.
So next week, we're going to continue talking about the brain and see what both the near and the more distant future will bring us as human beings. I think that you will be pleasantly surprised at just what may be in store for us soon, very soon.
We would like you, our listeners, to note that Dr. Lasky is one of several physicians right here in the Jacksonville area that has received the certification to recommend medical marijuana to those patients with certain qualifying diagnoses. For more information, you can call their office at 641-4411. They have also set up a special website at www.compassionatecarejacks.com, where you can get a whole lot more information on medical marijuana. Unfortunately, we have come to the end of another Hey Doc show.
So, from all of us here at Southside Medical Center, have a happy and healthy weekend. Goodbye.